I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Oceans, lakes, and rivers are getting choked with plastic that gets carelessly tossed away or escapes from landfills and waste collection systems. And we're talking about bottles and grocery bags, flip-flops, utensils, packaging, fishing nets, you name it. And while those plastics are visible, there's an invisible threat to marine life, and it's called microplastics. These are tiny beads, fibers, and fragments that can be found in water and along the sea floor. This plastic problem is not just unsightly, it's a threat to the fish and wildlife that depend on oceans and waterways. Global plastic production has increased dramatically in the last 50 years and shows little sign of slowing down. Today on Radio Times, the impact of all that plastic and what to do about it. And joining us is Chelsea Rockman. She's Smith Fellow in Conservation Biology from the Aquatic Health Program, and that's at the University of California in Davis. And Chelsea, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Marcus Erickson, research director and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, which studies the global distribution and ecological impacts of plastic marine pollution. He's also done sailing expeditions through all five subtropical gyres. And Marcus Erickson joining us from the NPR studios in Culver City. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Marcus, let me begin with you, but Chelsea, I want to hear from you as well. How do we assess, or how do you assess, just how much plastic there is in our oceans and waterways, considering, for instance, how just vast our oceans are? Marcus?
Well, I mean, our research began looking at, you know, plastics in the centers of the subtropical gyres. You know, 15 years ago, you heard of these islands of trash, these garbage patches. And what we did from there, we began the Five Gyres Institute to survey just the middle of nowhere, as far as you can get from land on the planet. And we were dragging nets, a real fine, fine mesh net across the ocean surface, and then basically just counting the particles in our nets and getting estimates of the count per square kilometer of ocean surface, and then working with some oceanographers, ocean modelers, that can then look at how the currents move and make some estimates on the global abundance. And we published this after 16 expeditions. And our total was around 5.25 trillion particles worldwide.
Wow.
From a quarter million tons of trash floating everywhere.
I don't even know how to think about that or even how to imagine it. I mean, I certainly have
seen
it's a big number, and I've seen video and images, photos of specific areas, perhaps, Marcus, the areas that you have been investigating, these gyres that seem to attract a lot of this plastic.
Well, it's interesting. Some of the photographs you see have been confused with what's near shore and what's in, you know, the rivers and lakes where things are accumulating near land. In the middle of the ocean, when you're standing there, you don't see a lot of the big stuff. It's
yeah.
Once you drag a net, you begin to see, like each time we drag a net in the middle of the gyres, you have like a small handful of this multicolored kaleidoscope of confetti, of small plastic fragments. The foam polystyrene, the thin plastic bags, that film, it's kind of shredded long before it gets to the gyres. So what's out there, what's the big stuff you see, you might see fishing buoys. That makes up more than half of the plastic out there in the middle of the gyres, and some fishing nets. But by and large, the consumer products are shredding long before they get to the middle of the gyres.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation. Chelsea, let's talk a little bit about this microplastic, these beads, the fibers, the fragments. What's the source, or what are the sources?
Right. But the sources are very important, and when you can get at sources, that's how you get at prevention. And so some of the sources that are familiar to you and I would be the little microbeads that we've heard so much about, the tiny little bits of plastic that are put in our personal care products like face wash, body wash, and even toothpaste. And then another source, you mentioned fibers, is actually from our clothing, from our washing machine. So you can imagine when you wash your clothing, little bits of your clothing fragment off and go out the back of the washing machine, which goes into the wastewater stream, which can end up in the ocean. A good way to picture it is think about the laundry lint that you pull from your dryer. It's the exact same thing. We just don't filter it the way we do in a dryer, and instead it goes out the back. Other sources are the virgin pellets, so the pre-production pellets of plastic. So some people may have heard of the word nurdles, but basically what these are tiny little bits of plastic about 3 millimeters in size, so a little smaller than the tip of a pencil eraser. And they are what's eventually melted down into Coke bottles and other plastic products. And so we see those out there. those are sources we can cut off because we know what they are. But what Marcus is talking about, all of those bits of larger items that are fragmented, when you get out there in the middle of the ocean, you can't tell what they are, wow, what they broke down from. They're just hundreds or thousands or millions of little fragments of small plastic products.
You have looked inside fish, I guess, cut them open to see what you have found in there. Are you finding plastic, Chelsea?
We sure do find plastic, and so do researchers from all over the world. So in some of our studies, we've just simply gone to fish markets and purchased fish, both in California but also in Indonesia, and we find plastic and fibers in about one quarter, so one in four fish and shellfish that we purchase.
Have you seen this as well, Marcus? In your travels around the world, are you seeing birds or fish that are maybe choking on some of this material?
Well, I think, as we're out there doing our research, we are observing more instances of marine organisms either entangled or ingesting plastic waste. If we do see, a dead fish or it comes up in our trawls, we'll open the gut. And occasionally we'll find, visible bits of plastic, small fragments that fish have foraged on. That's not uncommon. In fact, if you're on the west coast of the U.S. or other parts of the world and you see marine mammals, you might often see, scars around their necks, or you'll see sometimes birds, seabirds entangled, a fishing line, a hook in their mouth. I've seen that in pelicans. So I think it's happening more and more. We're seeing instances of not just ingestion, but also entanglement in our waste.
Chelsea, just picking up on some of the fish that you have looked at, what happens when they ingest plastic?
That is a great question. So that's primarily, I guess, what I would say that my research focuses on the most is what are the consequences, the toxicity of the plastic to animals. And Marcus just mentioned the big stuff. So, of course, there's the entanglement, and that entanglement can also occur in the gut, right? So it can actually harm the GI tract or the gastrointestinal tract. But what I've focused on a lot is the plastics in terms of toxicity. And so they can have a physical impact, like blockage in the gut. They can also have a chemical impact. So plastics are associated with lots of different chemicals, some of them that are toxic at certain concentrations. And these can transfer from the plastic to the animal and cause a hazardous effect. So in laboratory experiments, things that we've seen are liver toxicity. So actually changes in the liver in terms of stress, the liver actually becoming fatty, similar to what happens in liver degeneration from drinking too much alcohol. We've also seen tumors start to form in the livers of fish that are exposed to microplastics and their associated chemicals. In terms of reproductive impacts, we've seen changes in gene expression that's associated with egg development, which is important for reproduction. So there's lots of different effects that can occur, and other researchers have looked into. And so we're really starting to begin to understand what these impacts are, and I think they're enough to raise concern that the plastic ingestion in wildlife is actually causing an impact.
Chelsea, would it be fair to say that then we are eating the plastic we throw out if we eat fish or if we eat certain kind of fish?
Yes, it's absolutely fair to say that we are eating the plastic or that the mismanagement of our own waste is coming back to haunt us in our seafood. What we don't know yet is whether or not that's harmful to humans, right? So I guarantee I'm eating plastic when I eat oysters and shellfish. Whether or not that matters at the dose that we have them, I'm not so sure.
Well, Marcus, let me go back to you and talking about the mountains of trash strewn across our oceans and waterways. Is it because people are tossing their plastic water bottle into the trash and not recycling it? Or how, and I guess the larger question is, what percentage of what we either recycle or dispose of then ends up in our water?
I mean, that's a very good question, I think, and a very complicated answer. And we're just beginning to see, what are the sources? Is it the design of the product that there is no end-of-life plan for many of our single-use throwaway disposable products, like bags and bottles and straws and that nature? And then are there opportunities to put the waste in the right place? We know waste management is not up to speed in many parts of the world, although those countries might have an importation of all the single-use throwaway stuff and no place to put it. So is it the design? Is it the consumer behavior? What is the source of this trash gets out to the to the environment. I can say that recycling has not been efficient worldwide. If you look at the EPA data here in the U.S., we're recycling at 9.2%. Look at all it's produced and what all gets recovered. That's what the EPA reports. So I think there is room for recycling to improve. Waste management must improve. I really think there's a need for a design revolution where the products have the end of life really in mind. And we haven't seen that, across all products.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Marcus. And I think, and to you, Chelsea, we've all seen this photos. It tends to be more poor countries, perhaps in Southeast Asia, just mountains of trash along a shoreline. Oftentimes people picking through it, looking for something that they can resell or recycle. But is that, Marcus, a large source of the pollution we've been talking about?
Well, there was a recent publication by a colleague, Jenna Jambeck, who looked at 192 countries, and she found that if you look at the volumes of trash leaving land, it's from 20 countries, the U.S. being, number 20 in that top 20 list, but many of those being Southeast Asian countries. And again, you have to ask, is it the waste management, which surely is part of the problem, or is it the product design themselves? There's a lot of single-use packaging that gets exported to those countries without any waste management scheme to deal with them. And that's why you see those mountains of waste, in their rivers and on their beaches and even streams. You don't even see the water. There's so much plastic.
Yeah.
There is a definite need for waste management to improve.
Plastic, and Chelsea, I know there was a vote on to ban plastic microbeads in the U.S. Congress. Can you tell us where that went or if that went anywhere?
Sure, it absolutely went somewhere. President Obama signed that into law just before the new year in late December. So by the year 2018, microbeads will be removed from all rinse-off personal care products. So that includes face wash and body wash. And by 2019, it will be removed from toothpaste. So that law is now in effect federally in the United States. And different countries around the world are now working to create the same laws. So, for example, in Canada, where I actually live right now, they've just declared microbeads as a toxic substance under the Canadian Environmental Protection Act to set up a ban. And so these microbeads have now been removed. And again, this is just one of the many sources of microplastics. And I think it's an effective solution. I think we need the waste management that Marcus talks about tremendously. And we also need, piecemeal item-by-item bans on some of these single-use items that are less necessary in certain parts of the world, which include the microbeads.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking about all the plastic in our oceans, in our waterways, and it includes everything from the flip-flops that we wear and the microbeads that we've been talking about as well. That's Chelsea Rockman, Smith Fellow in Conservation Biology from the Aquatic Health Program at the University of California in Davis. Also with us, Marcus Erickson, Research Director, co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Why Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Marcus Erickson and Chelsea Rockman about the problem of plastics in our water system, whether it's oceans or waterways or rivers, and certainly what to do about it. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Marcus, for the uninitiated, help us understand what a ocean gyre is, how that works.
Sure. Gyres are these systems of rotating currents. Imagine the entire North Pacific or North Atlantic in this giant, clockwise swirl. For example, in California, the currents that the California current itself heads south and then loops around all the way to Japan, comes back up and comes across north. Mm. It makes a circular, this swirl of currents. In the middle of the gyres is where the wind and the waves kind of slow down. So when trash migrates at the centers, it kind of stops there because there's nothing else pushing it around, moving it, so it accumulates. And that's where it begins to fragment into smaller and smaller microplastics that then might sink and then go global. So gyres are these accumulation systems where currents will accumulate debris.
I remember doing a show a couple of years ago about what was called the Great Pacific Ocean Patch, the idea that there was just almost like an island of trash in the middle of the Pacific. Eric, does that exist?
That's That's a sensationalized myth.
Is it?
I'm afraid to say that. I mean, if you look at how things are in the middle of the gyres, when you get to the center of the oceans, and you look about, you don't see an island. There is no island. And the patch, there are no boundaries to these gyres. What you find as you get closer to the center are more and more microplastics, an abundance of these small stuff. When you drag a net, you'll get it. And I think the better analogy, and this is based on our research, about 16 expeditions, and then putting on a map those 5.25 trillion particles, you don't see defined little patches. What you see is something more akin to like a plastic smog. Small particles spread far and wide and increase their toxicity as they absorb other compounds, very much like the smog you might see over the biggest cities in the U.S. So I think we can change the metaphor from patch to, I think, a smog makes more sense.
That's something I think everyone can visualize. Chelsea, let me go back to you, and then we get some callers in on the conversation. You talk about the effect of some of this microplastic on spawning on fish eggs. Is there concern either that some fish will go extinct or that there will be some kind of health problems, if I can put it that way, or developmental problems based on the ingestion or the existence of these microplastics?
Well, when we've reviewed the literature, so going through the scientific evidence, basically what we find is that there haven't been a lot of studies asking those really important questions that you bring up. And so there haven't been very many research projects asking hypotheses or questions about populations, right? Will populations crash because of microplastics? How might it harm a species? There's a lot more studies looking at the harm to an individual organism. But recently, there's been a couple papers, one in PNAS by a group led by Susarelu, and then another paper that recently came out in Science by Lonsted and Eklof, and they've asked those questions. So do fish populations or oyster populations in a laboratory that ingest plastic at a concentration that's relevant to what we see in the environment, do we see decreases in their reproductive success? And what they have found is that you do. And so then that question is, how does that laboratory study translate to what we see out there in the field? So I think these laboratory tests are enough to cause concern and to suggest that we really need to get out there into the wild and look for some of this evidence in nature. Because if we do see population effects, right, health effects in the fish or decreases in fish stocks, that can impact both humans in terms of food security and also wildlife in terms of fish populations.
And are we seeing the ingestion of plastic up and down the food chain? If a bigger fish is eating a little fish, they're getting the plastic as well?
So we certainly see ingestion of plastic at multiple different levels of the food chain. So we see it in copepods, like zooplankton. We see it in fish, big and small. We see it in seabirds. We see it in marine mammals. We see it in sharks. Do we know whether this is an animal directly eating the plastic or, you know, if a plankton ate the plastic and the fish ate the plankton? We don't know, but we know that in a laboratory that trophic transfer through the food web can occur, and so there's no reason to believe it doesn't happen in nature.
These gyres, as you described them, Marcus, do they also have the effect of breaking down some of this plastic, so it might start as a flip-flop or a straw and then become microplastic?
It's interesting, you know, as the trash leaves our land, and that's where the majority is coming from, as it migrates toward the gyres, it is fragmenting. So, you know, when the idea of a garbage patch first came out, people were just chomping at the bit to go out there with giant nets and big barges and collect these mountains of waste and recycle it and make fuel and whatever. There were hundreds of schemes that we saw. But the reality is, as trash leaves our shorelines, it's breaking down very quickly. It's fragmenting. Ultraviolet light, you've got sunlight that's making it more brittle. You've got wave mechanics that then can crush brittle plastics. You have oxidation. You have chemical degradation happening, and even some low-level biodegradation. So when you get out to the middle of these gyres, we're not seeing the thin polyethylene, the bags. We're not seeing the foam polystyrene, your typical styrofoam cups. Those things fragment. What we find are the hard little fragments of very robust and thick plastics like toothbrushes and crates and buckets and chairs, things that even a chair, actually.
Even a chair, wow.
Yeah, they break into smaller particles, really hard fragments. The thin things are gone. The single-use throwaway plastics are typically gone. So it begs the question, where do you stop the problem? And the further upstream you can go, I mean, if you're going to do ocean cleanup, I mean, at a river mouth is the last place I think you can really reasonably collect a lot of trash before it harms marine life. But even then, even further upstream with design is where we really think it's at.
I was reading that some scientists are predicting that by the year 2050, I should say, there'll be more plastic than fish. I don't even exactly know how to think about that. But Chelsea, does that make sense to you? This will be in the oceans.
I have honestly have no idea how to answer that question. I'm not 100% sure how they come up with that number. I think there's no doubt that by 2050, the amount of plastic in the ocean will increase. The production trends are increasing every year. I think we see an increase between about, 4 to 6% of plastic being produced every year. And we don't right now have any sort of indication that waste management is becoming more efficient around the world. And so as the developing countries start to consume more and more plastic and their plastic consumption falls ahead of their waste management scheme, we'll see more in the ocean. But how we compare that to the number of fish, I'm not really sure. But I think in terms of how many animals will be exposed to the plastic debris, sure, I think more and more will be exposed at larger concentrations, which may indeed cause
problems.
Negative impact. Yeah, exactly. Big problem.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. We are talking about the amount of plastic in our water systems, whether it's the ocean or rivers or streams, and its effect on the wildlife that depends on our water, its possible effect on human beings as well, and what to do about it. And again, that's Chelsea Rockman. She's Smith Fellow in Conservation Biology from the Aquatic Health Program at the University of California in Davis. Marcus Erickson, Research Director, co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get some callers in. We've got Dan from Sellersville joining us on Radio Times. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was talking about this issue just the other day. We were gifted the brass wash with the micro beads in it, and I didn't want to use it and wanted to throw it out. But my fiance, who worked at a landfill, said that if it gets tossed in the trash and goes to a landfill, it will just explode and end up in our waterways and eventually in the ocean anyway. So my question is, how do you dispose of this properly? Or what do you do with the stuff once you have it and realize that it's bad?
Yeah, Dan, I appreciate the call. Let me toss that to you, Chelsea, because your area of expertise are these microbeads.
You know, I would actually toss that one out to Marcus because okay. I've heard him be asked that question so many times.
That's
and feels
right.
It's so much better than me.
Oh, such a modest guess. Go ahead, Marcus.
I think if you could just bring it back to the manufacturer, one thing is to just dispose of it, get rid of it through your waste management scheme. It depends on how good that is. As you said, Dan, your wife works at a landfill and she knows what happens, in landfills. At least there it's in a controlled space. But I think if you can bring it back to your manufacturer to drive home the point that design matters. We have to design our products and packaging for the sort of overpopulated, resource-scarce, closed system that our planet is now, that we have to realize. So I think getting it back to the manufacturer might pack the best punch in terms of showing corporations that we need this design revolution to happen now.
Marcus, you mentioned the fact that only 9.2% of recyclable plastics gets recycled. So I would assume not everything, of course, gets recycled, but just upping that would have an impact on the ocean.
Well, that's a very interesting statistic. There are two stats we just mentioned. One is the 9.2% recycling rate in the U.S., which is dismal. To go from when we first began making plastics in the mid-1950s for our domestic consumption, and now 50 years later, to only be at 9.2%. And then Chelsea mentioned something very interesting, and it's very true that between 4 and 6% is the growth rate, the projections for increased production of plastics. Right now, Plastics Europe just communicated the global production for 2013. 311 million tons of new plastic made in just that one year.
Wow.
And at that projected growth rate, if you just say 4%, That means by 2030, we'll have 600 million tons of plastics. And by 2050, you know, 1.2 billion tons of new plastics per year. Where is it going to go? I mean, do we improve recycling? Do we incinerate? Do we improve our design so that we create a circular economy? And that's where I think, and I'd love to hear yours and Chelsea's opinion on this, this division between the linear economy, where you make and then you consume and destroy plastics to create the supply or decrease the supply of recycled material, or do you create a circular economy where recycling gets really good and there's no need for much new plastic? And I see a division between industry and conservation over or how we solve this problem in the near future.
That's interesting. Chelsea, you want to weigh in on this? And let me get John, after you comment, from Chestnut Hill, who I think can speak to what we're talking about. But this idea of creating an economy that's not such a linear one, as Marcus just described.
So I think exactly, I mean, I struggle on this issue too, and I think a lot of people do, is that there's two ways to think about it. There's a short-term solution of how do we deal with the heaps and heaps of garbage on land and in our ocean right now. What do we do with it? How do we get rid of it? And number two, what do we do in the long run with the fact that this plastic production is increasing? And in the long run, a circular economy is necessary. So we need to value this material. Plastic is incredibly, incredibly cheap, yeah. But it's made from a very important resource. It's made from oil, fossil fuels. And it is incredibly persistent. So a straw or a bottle that we may use for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 hours, will last in the environment for hundreds to thousands of years. And so what do we do about this material? So I think we reduce our single use and we start to treat this material as more precious than we do right now. And we have a circular economy where we're recycling, reusing, and refusing some of the single use. But in the short term, we have a human health issue in some of these countries where this plastic is become part of their norm, right? So seeing plastic on the beach, in the ocean, in their fish has become a normal occurrence. And so what do you do with that material? And that's where I struggle between, do you incinerate it and produce energy out of it, or do you not do that? Because then you start a habit of doing that, whereas we may never reach a circular economy. And so that's where I go to experts, economists and waste management experts, to think about what do we do with this. But it's a real tough issue, and I think it's a real difference between a long term and a short term solution.
Chelsea mentioned a straw. I mean, it doesn't get more basic than that, Marcus. And maybe in the future there will be multiple uses for a plastic straw. I'm here holding in my hand, you know, a highlighter, something that I use to highlight my questions and things. I'm rethinking that as we speak here. But what we could keep these in barrels in our basements or something, but what do we do about stuff like that right now?
If you think about the single use, so not the highlighters, because you're going to use that for a very long time, and we could think about end of life for that. But when you think about straws and water bottles and plastic cups and cutlery, the single use items make up about half, at least 40% of the plastic industry in total. And so by stopping the use of these items, or at least making them more reusable in a circular economy, could reduce a very large proportion of the issue. And so I think the single-use items are a really important thing to focus on first. And I'm not sure if Marcus would agree or what his opinion on that would be.
Well, let's find out. Marcus, go ahead.
I do agree. I think that this is part of this design revolution. The single-use throwaway sort of culture we live in really has to end, because despite the best waste management practices, those single-use things, the microbeads, little plastic stir sticks, the sauce packets, a lot of these things just escape our system and pollute our oceans. So I think, yes, a design revolution must happen. It's not going to happen, I think, with a lot of the single product bans you see happening, and many of us are familiar with, you know, plastic bag bans or styrofoam bans or microbead bans that are happening. But I think bundling these products around their design flaws, like which of the products are the escape artists that are hard to get? I was in New York City last year. I counted 22 bags stuck in one tree. So there are these design flaws where they have a high incidence of polluting the environment. They're hard to recover, and perhaps they have high toxicity. They contain styrene or PVC. So I think they're, in the future, not looking at single product bans, but bundling them based on common design flaws, I think might be a next step to end this single-use throwaway culture that we've enjoyed for 50 years.
Has the plastic industry signed on to that, Marcus?
No, I don't think they have. And this goes back to the comments on that 4% projected growth rate. If recycling got really good, where would be the need to make new plastic? So it's a multi-billion dollar industry making new plastic every year. There's a need to make the old plastic, or desire to make the old plastic, obsolete through incineration, increase waste collection, and push for incineration. It is the essence of planned obsolescence to destroy the old material, to create space, a demand for new plastic. So I think industry, like, for example, Plastics Europe, they're pushing for no more landfills across Europe, but boosting incineration, you know, across the EU. And in the same in the U.S. is happening as well. So I think there is a debate, you know, what are the stakeholder motivations? I don't think the plastic industry wants to end the demand for plastics, regardless of design.
We're almost up in a break here, but Marcus, you mentioned the fact that while some areas have banned plastic bags, you're saying that's not enough? Is it just kind of a feel-good measure to make people feel like they're doing something really good for the environment?
Well, I think it is. It's very good. We need to do that. We need to see the most polluting products need to go. But I'm saying, in addition to that, that we maybe bundle them based on their common design flaw, the escape artists that are so difficult to recover from the environment. At the same time, they're the biggest polluters. They're so abundant. I think that's what we have to look at in the future.
We're talking about all the plastic in our oceans, in our waterways, and that's Marcus Erickson. Also with us, Chelsea Rockman, and we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Chelsea Rockman from the University of California, Davis, the Aquatic Health Program, and with Marcus Erickson. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Culver City, and he's research director, co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute. Let me get John from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, my question is, why can't we use some of these non-recycled plastics, such as vitamin bottles and prescription bottles, closing them up to make insulation air chambers, dropping them down in spaces with exterior walls, taking plastic bags, wrapping them in bundles, and putting them in crawl spaces where they could keep out vermin and also act as some insulation? So we use them closer to the home. This is a universal use for homeowners that insulate walls and also to create some crawl spaces.
It's a great question. A novel idea. I don't know. Marcus, have you looked at that? I mean, it seems that there are lots of potentially creative ideas like the one that John had, using it as
that
insulation, for instance.
Yeah, I have seen some of those examples. There's one company called Bifusion that can melt plastic bags and make cinder blocks out of waste. And there's one company, Boreo Skateboards, that is actually taking fishing nets, and they're turning those into skateboard decks and sunglasses. So are these novel ways to use plastic waste, if you can collect it? If you can collect it in a way that doesn't impact the environment before it impacts the environment, and the cost benefit exists. I don't think I can make a living pulling bags, plastic bags out of trees and get enough plastic bags to make a brick that'd be worth my while.
I hear you.
So I think there is room to use waste plastics and remanufacture them into new products. But the single-use throwaways, I mean, because of their ubiquity in the environment, difficulty to recover, I don't think the business case is there to reuse those and make products. They're just so difficult to get back from the environment.
Let me read an email for Terry. Do your guests see any BPA, the plastic coating inside beers, soda, and other cans in the water? Chelsea, you've looked at fish and opened them up to see what's inside. Are you finding evidence of BPA?
So we have actually looked for BPA in the water, and this was actually a study I did with Marcus. We had crossed the South Atlantic looking in the South Atlantic Gyre, and I was collecting fish samples, but also water samples and plastic samples to look for some of these chemicals that are indeed associated with plastics. And we did find bisphenol A in our samples, or BPA in our samples. You see it in waters. Others have reported it in different parts of the world in the oceans. We don't see it as much in the wildlife, and the reason is because it's it can be metabolized, so it doesn't accumulate the way some other contaminants do, like some of the pesticides and PCBs. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't get into animals, and that doesn't mean that it cannot cause an impact. So we see it in some animals. We see it in the water column, but it's a bit less persistent, so it's a little bit tricky to say whether or not we see it in an animal directly because of the plastic debris in the ocean. But what I will say is that these chemicals are in a lot of products that we use in our homes. And so we know when we use these products like cans and cups and we drink things that have bisphenol A that it can get into us. And when we go to the bathroom, it's in our urine and it goes through the wastewater treatment plant. And so wastewater treatment plants are a large source of BPA into lakes and oceans and rivers. And so when we see it that way, sure, it may be a direct source of plastic, but it's not quite the same source as when you think of plastic in ocean, animal eats it, gets into animal, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Chelsea, let me pick up on something you said earlier about synthetic fibers and the fact that our clothing contains synthetic fibers. How serious a problem is that? And is it the same kind of process, which is you wash it, it's sort of like the lint, and it ends up in our water supply?
So we know, so there are trends in science, and the microbeads trended, and now the fibers are trending, right? So that's what I see a lot of papers coming through the pipeline about. And so there's no doubt that the clothing, when we wash it, that it sheds fibers, and that it actually happens more in a top-loading washing machine, because you have that pole in the middle that's moving things around. It's a bit more disruptive. And that those fibers go out the back of the washing machine to a wastewater treatment plant where some are removed in the sludge and some go out into the environment. So we know the source, and we know that some materials shed more than others. For example, fleeces, which
interesting,
they look like a fuzzy stuffed animal,
yep,
shed fibers. And so we know that we are a large source of that into the environment through our washing machines, and we now see them in fish. So anecdotally, when we sample fish from the Great Lakes, we find fibers in almost all of them. Work that's not published yet, and we've also seen it in our fish in from California.
And are these synthetic fibers and natural fibers?
It's a combination, yeah. So some of them are cotton, and some of them are synthetic and plastic. They're all anthropogenic, right? So they're all coming from humans, but not all of them are plastic.
Let me see what Anne from Morristown has to say. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to ask about a company that's producing plastics that are made from plant products versus petroleum. The company's called Novamont, and it's in Italy. I know that they're sending beads here to be processed, but apparently it's not doing so well, I guess because financially it's not at a feasible price. Is there more being done? Because, frankly, even recycling is just kicking the problem down the road. Plastics are here to stay once they're produced. Isn't there more, or could there be more done with something other than a petroleum-based plastic?
And let me toss that to Marcus Erickson. Marcus, can you respond to that?
Sure. I think that there's a lot of innovative technologies around biopolymers, but you have to make sure that the distinction isn't, are they making the same polymer that you get from fossil fuels from plants? You can make polyethylene PET and polypropylene from plants. Or is it a degradable polymer like PHA, polyhydroxyl alkanoate, which is one of the only ones we see that can degrade in a nearshore warm marine environment, tropical waters. So I think there are innovations happening. We are seeing, you know, PHA, even that was proposed actually as a replacement for microbeads. So there are some biopolymers out there. They probably have a hard time competing with the status quo, which are very cheap plastics from fossil fuels. And with the price of fossil fuels dropping, we're seeing a lot of countries just making lots and lots of pellets from plastics, new virgin plastics. So they do exist. They just have a hard time competing in the market.
An email from Bobby. How much of the problem comes from buying bottled water? Do you know the answer to that, Chelsea?
How much of the problem?
It's from bottled water.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I could necessarily quantify it, but I think that we certainly see it a lot on the coast. And so, of course, we find it in some of our samples in terms of when you're pulling up large pieces of plastic. But the one thing I would say is that in terms of bottled water, One thing I notice when I go into the developing world is that in a lot of these countries, if you think about it, if you've traveled there, you can't drink the water from the tap. You have to buy the bottled water. And the people who live there buy the bottled water as well. So we're selling them lots and lots of these bottles of this bottled water with no, as Marcus said, end of life plan for it. And so they don't always have the PET recycling. They don't always have a landfill for that waste. And so I see bottled water and cups for bottled water all over beaches and some of the places I've worked around the world that don't have water, clean drinking water. And so I think in terms of this issue, when, you know, the last letter asked about what they called recycling, almost like a Band-Aid, I think for bottled water, we need clean drinking water around the world so that we don't have to have the bottled water as a necessity in some of these locations.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Marcus, should we feel worried, depressed about our future as we talk about the amount of plastic in our waters?
I think not depressed at all. I mean, if I were depressed and had no hope, I wouldn't be here. You know,
so I think
that there are there's a lot of movement happening. You know, around the world, you're seeing, for example, NGOs in Southeast Asia talking with NGOs across the U.S. and Europe about how to deal with these waste issues, waste management, and the design of products. Another interesting note to make is that the plastic that's out there that's in the ocean right now, it's not there forever on the surface. It is fragmenting, and a lot of it is sinking. And what scientists think is the ultimate repository for plastics at sea is fragmentation, sinking, and sedimentation. But the ocean, I think, if we leave the ocean alone, it can take care of itself to a large degree. One example I often give is our tar balls. You may recall in the 70s and 80s and early 90s that you'd walk on a beach in much of the world and you'd step in tar.
Yes.
I grew up in Louisiana and you'd always go to the Gulf and step in tar, always clean your feet after a day at the beach. But as soon as MARPOL, it's an international agreement that stopped the big ships that were transporting petroleum from washing out their ships at sea, which was just blasting all this petroleum out of their hulls into the ocean. That was the primary source. Once that happened, within less than 10 years, you saw a drastic reduction in these tar balls on beaches. The ocean kicked it out. So I think if we can, you know, do no harm, you know, stop the flow of trash to the oceans by better waste management, better design upstream, I think we'll see the ocean will take care of itself. We'll deposit that in deep sea sediments.
Let me see what George from Ocean City, New Jersey has to say. Hi, George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. My question was about a remediation using the genetic revolution that we have, maybe manufacturing a bacteria that would thrive in the oceans and digest plastics.
It's interesting you say that because, George, I'm looking at a couple of my screens that I have here, and a number of people are wondering about something just like that. Chelsea, do you see that as a positive way to deal with what we've been talking about?
You know, I would like to be optimistic about it, and we've seen some papers. I think a paper came out in Science not too long ago about an organism that could ingest PET, and I think on some scales, right, and if we could release the organism in a wastewater treatment plant, it could ingest the microbeads. But I really worry about, we call it biological control. So as a chemist and toxicologist, we think a lot about this issue in terms of pesticides, right, instead of spraying chemical pesticides, can we use a sort of biological control to get rid of the pests instead of the chemical? And every time we have, we fail. And so a cane toad is a great example of that. Cane toads are now invasive all over the world. They were brought into cane fields to get rid of pests. It didn't work. They didn't eat the pest, and they've now taken over and caused other harm to the ecosystem. So while I think it has a potential promise in some forms, if we can release them and keep them contained in landfills and waste management sites, it could potentially do some of the work. But I worry about it as the catch-all solution.
Let me get, looks like Tony from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was wondering how much individual littering. I know you've been talking about a lot about the like industrial waste management, but especially living down here in South Philly, all over Philly, I've noticed just a lot of people. It's been a pet peeve of mine moving into the city. There's just people just throw trash everywhere and ignore trash cans constantly. And seeing the, I walked the Wissahickon one time after it flooded, and it was just, all the trees were covered in a sea of plastic bags. And I'm wondering, is that like a large component, or is, you know, where does that fall?
Sure, it's a good question. Let me put that to you, Marcus. Do we know how much of it is just people willy-nilly tossing out their trash in irresponsible ways?
That's a very good point, and that I'm sure is a huge part of it. You know, worldwide, there's, you know, like you said, in Philly, you've got garbage cans there, and people might, you know, stack that one more cup on top of the can instead of holding to the next can. Or they just ignore it altogether, and they'll put that cup on the park bench or something. So I think that happens. Huge need for public education, for sure. But then, again, I'd like to see a much smarter design products. If that bottle were worth a nickel, I guarantee, you know, people are not going to throw it away. If you had to pay 5 cents for a plastic bag, most folks aren't going to take the bag in the first place. So, yes, I totally agree. It's behavior. There's a need for public education. But I think smarter products and better waste management systems. If I could add real quick that previous caller, the comment about a bacteria that eats plastics. Keep in mind, you've got millions of boats made of plastic out there, fiberglass resins, and boat docks, and you've got buoys, entire fishing industry. So whatever you, the unintended consequences could be huge, releasing some modified bacteria.
Marcus, how much of what the plastic we've been talking about does come from fishing, from nets, and all the paraphernalia that goes along with commercial fishing?
That's a very interesting conversation. Where is it really coming from? We almost all agree it's most coming from land, but a lot does come from the maritime industries. There are restrictions, of course, on litter at sea. The MARPOL agreement from the mid-'80s, you know, says you cannot put plastic in the ocean anywhere at any time. So the bigger fishing fleets, the bigger container fleets, international navies, and ocean liners are typically not polluting, although there are some occasions where it's been documented they still do. It's so difficult to monitor anyone polluting in the marine environment, but internationally it's illegal to do so. The split is 80-20, 80% from land, 20% from the maritime industries. But it's very difficult to pinpoint those numbers.
Yeah. And to you, Chelsea, we're almost out of time here, but we haven't really talked about the plankton, the marine life that the fish depend on. Are we seeing plastics embedding itself in that part of our ecosystem?
We are, yeah. We do see plastic at every level of the food chain. And so we do. There have been reports of people finding it in plankton and at the base of the food chain. And but I would say, you know, the caller that called in and asked about the littering, and I, you know, we're at almost at the end of the show, and I would almost thank them for asking that question, because as you said earlier, should we just walk away depressed? And it's so easy to just end on a depressing note, like, yes, it's in every level of the food chain. But then there's that side of what can we do as individuals, and human behavior is a huge part of this issue. And so education is a ginormous, which is not a word, a huge solution.
And, we like and ginormous,
when
we yeah.
When we talk about all the political moves, or the things we're talking about, you know, top down, like changing production and changing laws, one of the biggest things I learned from getting involved in the microbead legislation is that our voice counts. And our governments and our councilmen want to hear from us and hear that we think this issue is important. And so there's so much we can do. And, you know, I am optimistic, as Marcus said. I wouldn't be here if we didn't think that there was a chance for positive change.
Well, we're glad you both were here. Chelsea Rockman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Marcus Erickson, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're welcome. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Madison Poulter helping us out this week. The show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.